Okay, well, we are just past the 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead now and mute all. As usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or a comment. And remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise to a minimum. And tonight, thanks to Alan, we will have the contents of the chat window, the audio track, and the slide deck will be up on our website, and maybe even a bonus of a video clip might actually appear there as well. We'll see. It's a big video clip. Welcome all. Welcome any new people we have with us tonight. As always, we welcome guests at any time at the Auto PC User Group. If you want to join, come to our website on the homepage, and you can go to the Join or Renew button at the top, and that'll lead you through where you can actually join up. And it's just $20 a year, but feel free to join as a guest if you want to do so that way. And I guess with that, I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck, and I think he's probably going to kick it right back to me. Oh, maybe not.
No, first of all, I have a public service announcement, a pizza service announcement. If you've been paying attention to the pre-meeting deck, you would have seen that there's no Q&A next week, and that's because next week is our regular monthly meeting. However, it's also not going to be an online meeting. It's an in-person pizza party. And so you've been hearing about this for weeks now. And this is your last call, basically. Next week is the week. And if you want to go to the pizza party, you have to register by sending an email to this address. And
don't come last year, though. Come this year on June 11th, 2025. Or 2 years ago. Don't come 2 years ago.
Oops. I guess I'll fix that, right? Okay, moving along. I am going to kick it over to Chris, because Chris has got a share for us.
And Alan is going to give me slide control.
That's a good idea.
So this was kind of cool. I came across this as I was trying to do something. And I was trying to do a capture of a YouTube video. And one of the problems is if you pause the YouTube video, you get the controls down at the bottom. And unfortunately, there's no supported way to actually remove those controls. So in this case here, it would sort of chop off a little bit at the bottom of the logos on the T-shirts and that. And I wanted to find a way to get rid of those controls. So I went hunting. And I found a Hide Chrome extension. And the advance will work for me. There we go. Sorry, these sort of stacked up. Okay, here we go. Okay, so it's in the Chrome Web Store, and if you just search for Hide, H-Y-D-E, and then choose Hide, and actually I have a typo on there. It's Hide and then dash H-I-D-E, the YouTube video player, and then just install that on your PC into Chrome. And then the way it works is that you pause your video as normal and the video controls will appear on the screen. And very simply, you just hit Control M and the controls disappear. And then you can take your snapshot and you will get it that way. And if you want the controls back, all you have to do is hit the Control M a second time and the controls will come back. So very easy, free, and if you want to be able to capture full screens when you pause the video, that's the tool to use. That's it.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So I now have a share on file renaming, and in particular, batch file renaming. I don't like the way that digital cameras name their images, and this I don't find this image 3901.jpg terribly useful, and especially when you've got 500 videos to sort through, and it's kind of hard to keep track of everything. So I much prefer to rename everything to give them a name that at least means something to me. And normally when I'm dealing with images, I use Vascom Image Viewer, which is a freeware program. And it has a batch renaming tool built into it. And that's fine for images, but it only works with certain file formats. So if you have other files that you want to rename, you need a different system. Now, but basically what you end up with is this. You've got a whole bunch of thumbnails here with these weird and wonderful names. And if you look at it in File Explorer, then, you know, they're 3900, 3901, 3902, and it goes on forever. So my application of choice is right now is called Advanced Renamer, I think it is. I wrote a little article for the last newsletter, the recent newsletter. So if you want to know more about it, you can consult the June issue of the club's newsletter. So this is Advanced Renamer. This is their website. So you basically just go to their website, download the program, and install it. And it's available for Windows and the Mac environment. So in Windows, you end up with a screen that looks like this. And to me, this isn't terribly intuitive because when I look at the plus sign in the top left-hand corner here, I would kind of go over here first of all to see what to do, and it's got this plus sign, but that's not really what you want. What you want is this one over here, because the first thing you want to do is add some files. So you need to find some files that you want to be renamed, and you can rename files, you can rename folders. But if you click on this files link here, then it opens up a File Explorer type browser, so you can drill down into your system and find the files, the photographs in this case that I want to rename. I say I want them all, and then I just say open, and it basically copies them all into the into the main window. So now we have, these are the files that we're going to work on. So now we can go over to the left-hand side here and hit this button right here, which is add a renaming method. So we're going to tell Advanced Renamer how we want these files to be renamed using a kind of a pattern matching type system. And you've got a whole raft of options. You can give it a new name, you can change the case, the upper and lower case, and you can remove stuff and you renumber things and all kinds of wonderful things. I'm actually just interested right now in giving everything a different name. So I'm going to choose new name. And you notice that by default here, it's got quite a complicated pattern. It's using a bunch of substrings, so substring 1 to 4, so the first 4 characters, and then a hyphen, and then do a substring again, and then another hyphen, then another substring. So you can mix and match these things. You've got a whole raft of stuff down here where you can add random numbers and deal with CSV files and all kinds of wonderful things. And I prefer a much simpler technique. My technique is just blank that whole section and then type in something. So I switch to the default tab here, and then I type in, and I want it to be Limpkin, a hyphen, and then I put in this increment number tab, tag. So I'm going to get, I'm going to get Limpkin-01, Limpkin-02, Limpkin-03, which is obviously, for me, that's a meaningful name. I know exactly what those things are going to be. However, the other thing I don't really like is the uppercase extension, JPG. But I can fix that too because I'm allowed to add another renaming method. So I'm going to add a second one as well as a new name. I'm going to tell it to replace the capital JPEG with a lowercase JPEG. And you notice that when I do that, the preview is that now I've got Limpkin-01, lowercase JPEG, 02, lowercase JPEG, etc. So now things are set up basically the way I want them to be. So all I have to do is now everything's kosher. I can just hit the start batch button here. And it just gives me a warning. It says, make sure that your renaming settings are correct, and you've added two methods or 20 files, and you're in a rename mode. And if everything's okay, then you can just hit start. And instantly, or almost instantly, the window clears, which is kind of interesting. It doesn't really tell you what's happened, except if you look down here, it says that the last result was that it renamed 20 items, my 20 pictures, and it didn't find any errors, so presumably everything went well. And we can check that by going to File Explorer and go back to that folder, and we can see that now our files have the names that we wanted them to be. And if I go back to my image viewer, then you can see that now all the thumbnails have the new file names. And again, the beauty of Advanced Renamer is it doesn't only work for JPEGs. You can do any type of files, and it's very powerful because you've got these multiple renaming functions. So you can do all kinds of weird and wonderful things and make the name of the file or the group of files, you can make those names basically exactly what you'd like them to be. So it's a really useful little program. Again, it's freeware, and it works really well. Okay, anything in the chat, questions?
No questions. Tom threw in a link to another one, Bulk Rename Utility. So if people don't like the one that you have there,
yeah, the Advanced
there's
Renamer.
Another one, Advanced Renamer, then there's another option people can check out.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of them if you do a Google search, but some of you'll find they have very complicated renaming conventions, so you have to find one that works for you, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have,
okay, so thanks, everyone.
Could I ask a question? If you have files that have a lot of network names in it, because they put dots all over the place, which makes it difficult for sorting file names, because the space doesn't count the same thing as a dot. Is there a way that you can select parts of a file name and have it remove the dots in that space?
Yeah, you remember that that substring command? You can basically choose any part of the file name string and do things with it.
You can also use the regular expression if the lengths vary.
Sorry, what was that?
The lengths of something, you showed a substring example at the start, or at least that's how it initialized. But you can also use the regular expression option in that program to handle when the strings are of variable length, and so long as you can identify them in a regular expression, or regex.
Yeah, regular expressions are really cool. They're extremely powerful. You can do things like, you know, you select any character that is a letter, or, you know, any number of numbers, or, you know, all kinds of things that you can do with regular expressions.
Yeah, it does have a lot of powerful features, that's for sure.
One thing I would suggest, if you want to find the file again, I use the program Everything, which looks at the file names, and you can pick up bits and pieces of the file name when you search. And I would suggest, if you want to find files again, that you have a good description in them. If you have all pictures of those Limpkins, you could put in, add in, as well as Limpkin 01, you could add in Limpkin 01 sitting on a tree, Limpkin 01 on a branch, etc. You can actually retrieve it again.
Yeah, and I found it's a good idea. It's a good idea to have everything stay resident in memory as well, because if you take it out, it takes a lot longer to start up again if you want to find anything. Whereas if you keep it running in the background, it'll find them all instantly.
Yeah, you mean the program Everything.
Yeah.
The other point is for photography, is that if you use the, you know, Control A in Explorer and just go to properties and tag them with the name Limpkin, then you can always search on the word Limpkin and don't pop up. The advantage of that is you've got them all Limpkin here, but because you always have your originals in another folder. Your originals are maybe going to be a different name if you haven't renamed them both. So just keep that in mind if it's photography.
Yeah, my preference rather than use tags is just to open the folder in this program and I can see all the pictures in the thumbnail. So I know whether the Limpkin's sitting on the tree or not. Anyway, it's how you like to use your computer, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, next up, Chris has a tip for us, a computer basics item.
Yeah, so this was something that I sort of kicked myself in the butt a little bit on this one because I was struggling with working in Excel, and I all of a sudden realized that I was forgetting about a function that is available in Excel that can make things an awful lot easier for you. So Excel can handle huge amounts of data, like millions of rows and thousands of columns and things like that. And it supports all kinds of data types. So, of course, numbers and text are the things you normally have. But then you can have charts and pivot tables and so forth that are built on the numbers and the text that you have in your Excel workbook. So you can have an awful lot more than you can view in that single view that you see on the screen. And if it'll advance for me, come on. There we go. So it can be difficult if you want to work in one section of your workbook or your worksheet and see what the effect is in another section, whether it's a calculation, a chart, or whatever that is contingent on the data that you're actually looking at. And the advance is not working very well tonight. Okay. Alan, I'll let you do it. So can you go back one? Okay. So, yeah, okay. Go forward one. Okay. So for an example, you have, you know, part of your worksheet is data, and then you have a chart that, where you're visualizing that data. Next. And if you don't work in Excel, keep watching anyways, because there may be things that will be applicable to how you use your computer as well. Next. Okay, so here we have an example where we have data at the top of the worksheet, and then we have a chart down below. And it's convenient to see both the data as well as the chart. And one of the problems with having them like this, where you have the data table and the chart on a single sheet, is that as you add additional data, you might have to move that chart down farther or over to the side or something like that. And it just becomes a little bit awkward. It's not impossible, but a little bit awkward to actually work with it that way. Next. Okay, so here's what can happen as you move through your data or as you add additional data. The chart all of a sudden might not be visible on the screen. So you can't see the effect as you change the numbers in your table, and then you don't see the effect because you have to scroll down to look at that. Next. So how about putting the data in the chart on separate sheets? That's eminently doable. So here we have a tab called Data, and it is strictly all the data. We don't put the chart on the same sheet at all. There's no need to move the chart because it's not on the same sheet as you add more data onto it. And no need to scroll to find the chart because next, you have the chart on a separate sheet and it just has the chart, none of the numbers. And so anytime you need to be able to see the chart, you just click on the chart tab and it pops to the foreground. You want to go back to your data, you click on the data tab and you go back and you're looking at just your data. Next. Of course, the problem with this, next, problem is while you're viewing your data, you can't see the chart. And while you're viewing your chart, you can't see the data. So you do have to flip back and forth between those. Next. But what if you could actually see both tabs at one time? And it turns out really you can. So if you go to the View tab on the ribbon, next, and then you choose the Windows section on the tab, or on the ribbon, next, and you choose New Window, next. And then all of a sudden you'll have two separate windows, and one of them you can have selecting the Data tab in one window, next, And on the other window, you can select the Chart tab. Next. Now, because you have two of them, it's a window into the same workbook. It's not separate files or anything like that. So you can choose a different tab for each of the windows. As the data changes in the data tab, immediately you can see the change in the chart. So you can scroll through your data, play around with any of the numbers, and you'll immediately see in the other window the chart updating. Really kind of neat. Keep in mind, they're the same workbook. They're just different views into that same data. Next. Okay, can I do this in other programs? Next. And well, I did say to keep watching, even if you don't use Excel. So next. How about in PowerPoint? So what if you could create and edit your agenda slide, next, while going through your slides? So if you have a lot of slides and you haven't generated an agenda slide, this is an easy way where you can have them in a separate window. And on that right side, you would just scroll through it and you'd say, oh, okay, I have to add this to the agenda. Then you just click in the other window, add it to the agenda slide, go back over to the other one, scroll down, and you can continue to see all your content while you're building the agenda slide, and the agenda slide is always visible as you scroll down through the data. Next. How about in Microsoft Word? So in this case here, I had a document with a whole bunch of font samples, and I wanted to compare the font sample on page 2 with the font sample on page 11. Why not have two views into that same document where I can scroll them independently, and then I can compare the fonts on different pages. Next. How about if you have LibreOffice Impress in Linux? So again, I can go to the Window menu option and do New Window. And as a note there, of course, it works in LibreOffice Impress in Windows as well. Next. How about if you're reading a PDF file? So here I have a PDF file. It was fairly technical, and so I might want to be able to refer to the glossary all the time as I scroll through the document so that as I come across an unfamiliar term, I don't have to jump to a different place in the document and then find my way back to the same content. I can just have it in a separate window. Now, in this case here, Foxit Reader actually allows you to split it within the single document or single window, so you can go to View and Split. And then within the one Foxit Reader document window, it will actually split it, and you can scroll, you can grab the handle between the two windows and make them bigger or smaller, so you can size them up the way that you actually want them. And then those two sides can be scrolled independently. Next. Foxit also allows you to do similar to what we were doing in Excel and Word and PowerPoint, where you can have it as separate windows that are actually there. So if you want to do that, in Foxit Reader, you go to File, Preferences, Documents, and you check the option Allow Multiple Instances, and then you can open up the same PDF file in two separate windows. And then, of course, they're scrollable as separate entities. Next. So anytime you need to scroll to see or be able to view different parts of a single document at the same time, next. In Microsoft Office or Microsoft 365, go to the View tab in the ribbon, Windows section, New Window. In LibreOffice, you go to Window, New Window. In Foxit Reader, you can do either the View Split or File Preferences Documents Allow Multiple Instances if you want them to be in separate windows. Next. And for any other programs, what I would suggest you do is just go to Perplexity AI and say, can I view different parts of a document at the same time using whatever program it is that you're using? And you might be surprised the number of programs that will actually support the ability to be able to see different parts of the same document at the same time. Some you can't, but it's not a bad thing to try out. Remember that they're not separate documents. So if you go in, you're editing one of them, it's the same document. It's just different views into that same document. Okay? So changes in one view are reflected in the other view automatically for you. So hopefully that'll help people out. Again, if you ever have a need to view different parts of a document at the same time without massively scrolling through your document, finding a new section, and then finding your way back, this can be a handy way to do it. And that's it.
Yeah, got a quick question.
Just to add to your other programs note, Tom noted that Sumatra PDF does the same thing as Foxit, I guess.
We had another question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if by the time you get at least two windows open, sometimes the print is very small, and I'm assuming within each window you can magnify the image so you can read the print?
Again, that's dependent on the program. So it's completely okay. Independent of the idea that they are two views into the document. So if your document allows you to, or your program allows you to zoom in on the document, either of the two windows that you have open, or multiple windows, because you can have more than two, they would be each independently zoomable.
Okay, thanks.
So Tom has also noted that Control and N will create new windows in most programs.
Yeah, some of them it'll be a new document for Control N and things like that. So, again, if you're unsure, you could always ask Perplexity, or you could just try Control N in your program and see what it actually does. But try it out. I found it it's really, really handy.
Yeah, there's a bunch of comments in the chat saying exactly that, Chris, and I will echo that because I'm working on a spreadsheet right now where I have exactly that problem. I put the chart at the top of the sheet, but the data is expanding down rather quickly. So it will actually be useful to have them in separate tabs like that. Okay, so thanks very much, Chris. And just a note, that was a computer basics item. And there's lots of people in this club who can help you with basic computer operations. However, we really need to know what it is that you need to know. We can make them up as we go along, pretty much as Chris did. He found out this neat trick and he's passing it along. But if there's something that you need to know that we can probably help you with, as always, just send us an email and we'll find somebody who can give us the answer. Okay, well, keeping Chris busy, he's going to put his physicist hat on and talk about quantum computing.
Yeah, so I'm going to actually do a share on here. And so I'm going to replace the current share. And I have to make sure I share sound and share. I'm taking over now.
Yep.
So, yeah, anybody who's seen my shares on Q&A knows that I'm a big fan of Dave Plummer. He's a retired Microsoft engineer and programmer, and he has a marvelous way of explaining technical things in relatively easy-to-understand terms. And he also has a lot of insight into the way things worked in Microsoft when he was around. So he has a fascinating view on his take on things. So he had one that just came out, I think, a day or so ago, on quantum computing. And I have always found quantum computing to be a rather strange topic to talk about. And so his channel is called Dave's Garage, and he explains qubits. And these are these strange things that rather than binary objects that can be a one or a zero, a qubit can actually be a one or a zero or a one and a zero at the same time. And then he talks about superposition and entanglement and how all three of those sort of combine together to actually make for astoundingly complex calculations done very, very quickly. And I think IBM just had one recently that they completed something in, I forget what it was, a couple of hundred minutes or something, that a classical computer would take something like 10,000 years to actually calculate. So it is pretty impressive what if it really comes to fruition, which everybody is expecting it will, quantum computing is going to revolutionize an awful lot of things. And he has a lot of talk about what sort of problems that they can solve. Things like developing drugs in months instead of years, cracking encryption, something that would take a supercomputer 10,000 years to crack, could be cracked in a matter of minutes or seconds, all kinds of things like that. So it's really, really fascinating. And, you know, it is one of the better explanations that I have seen about quantum computing. But when it comes right down to it, even Dave's explanation, I was left sort of scratching my head. And it reminded me of a video that I saw a while back, And this is how I sort of felt when after watching Dave's video.
For a number of years now, work has been proceeding in order to bring perfection to the crudely conceived idea of an edge device that would not only supply granular controlled packet transmission for use in multilateral data networking applications, but would also be capable of automatically binding and synchronizing the asymmetric block-based storage elements. Today, we are proud to announce the launch of the SD-WAN Turbo Cloud Encabulator. A hybridized new principle of this technology has been implemented, where instead of data being transported via relative protocols of multiple labels, switched via an oscillating current, it is produced through the modal interaction of amalgamated links and aggregated packets. The new architecture is designed on a framework of pre-extruded Kubernetes container orchestration, surmounted by malleable logarithmic relays in such a way that the two spurving headers are in a direct line with the panometric cells they reside on. The latter consists simply of two, not six, distributional ordinances so fitted to the ambifacient ingress and egress points on the portal so that side tunneling of data is effectively eliminated. Once the hypervisor has been initiated into the multi-tenanted, multi-hybrid, multi-cloud, DevOps have full access to the API, thus giving virtualized direct control of the UCPE, VCPE, and other OSI Layer 7 deployments in a manner far simpler than your standard containerization architectures. The SD-WAN Turbo Cloud Encabulator has now reached a higher level of development and is being successfully used in the operation of Reciproco sites to reduce sinusoidal jitteration.
So I was really glad that he pointed out that it was two and not six distributional ordinances in that system. You know, but that's sort of how I feel a little bit when I see things that are talking about quantum computing. But it is an interesting video from Dave Plummer to watch, and if nothing else, it gives a flavor of what is to be expected to be coming probably within the next 10 to 20 years. And so it's not that far off that we're going to have some real explosion in capabilities for computing.
He sounded a lot like a character off Doctor Who, didn't he? Do you remember the very first sale of the quantum computer, the very first one?
They've been sold?
Yeah. The very first one was built in British Columbia and sold to Google for $1 billion Canadian.
We should do that again.
That wasn't that long ago either.
Yeah, as Dave Plummer points out, you know, companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft and IBM are pouring billions of dollars into quantum computing.
Does he touch on quantum locking as well?
I don't recall.
The quantum lock is another big thing because it means that transmissions can be completely verified whether it's been intercepted or not. It's to do with when you look at something, it changes it quantum mechanics.
Yeah, he talks a lot about error correction and things like that and how that exponentially makes things more difficult and how these quantum bits are not all that stable. And so they have to have a way of verifying that the information is actually correct and correcting information that is wrong and things like that. So it really is. It's only a 10-minute video, so it's not going to take away a lot of your life to watch it. I highly recommend that people take a look and see what's coming. And with that, I'll turn it back to Alan.
Okay, and I'll turn it back to Chris.
Oh, right back to me. Okay, I'll have you do the advancement on this as well. Space Selfie. This is he says it's going to be free forever, a service from Mark Rober. And anybody who is not familiar with Mark Rober, he has a YouTube channel, and he does some really, really funny stuff. He has obstacle courses in his backyard that he has created for squirrels that they had to actually navigate a really strange obstacle course in order to get the peanuts at the end. He's had, for Porch Pirates, he's built packages that include a phone so he can capture the video of them opening this package, at which point a stink bomb goes off and glitter flies out of the package and things like that. He's really brilliant. YouTuber. So he created this this service, and he tags it with the fact that he spent $5 million so you can go to space for free. Next. And you can sign up to get your own selfie done. And the URL is there, and I'll paste that into the chat as well. Let me just grab that before I forget about it and continue on. Okay, next. Okay, there is a video that is the process that he actually went through over a couple of years to actually bring this to fruition. And it's a really interesting video to watch. Next. So how it works is that he has actually launched a satellite into space, and this is what cost him the $5 million. So there is a satellite up there now that is owned by him. Next. On that satellite, there is a camera. Next. And there's a screen, an LCD screen. Next. Your picture gets beamed up to the satellite. Next. And then the picture is displayed on the screen, and the camera takes a picture of it, and then it gets beamed back to Earth. Next. And then it gets posted to a custom URL that will be just for you when you actually sign up for this. Next. So the first ever selfie was taken from space was Fat Gus. That was one of the squirrels that he had in his backyard that was navigating his obstacle course. And so this is the sort of thing that you can actually expect. Next. So I did it. And so I went onto the site, and immediately after uploading my selfie or my picture, whatever it is, then I get a note saying that it's being reviewed because he does make sure that no nudes are allowed and things like that. It has to be a person, things like that. And so the next day I got an email from him saying that they recognized that it was successfully uploaded, and then they're going to email me again when the selfie is ready to be taken from space. And you can actually specify a location. So I did specify that I wanted the background to be Ottawa. Now, it might be covered in clouds or something like that. I don't know. But at any rate, next. Now, I was a little bit disappointed because it said due to the hundreds of thousands of uploads that they've already gotten at that point, the wait could be up to a year. So I don't hold my breath on it, but it should be coming at some point. I think that was the end of it. Next. Oh, yeah, okay. So, again, to sign up for your own selfie, go to that URL, and that's pasted into the chat window, and you can have your own selfie taken from space, and Mark promises that this is going to be free forever. Well, I think it's advertising that is paying for it at Crunch Labs, but it's available for all users on Earth free of charge. That's it.
Apparently, you could pay for it. Tom says he paid to get in early and is having a picture with his family.
The I think the paid way is you actually sign up for something from Crunch Labs, and so you're effectively paying for it, but you are getting something as well from Crunch Labs, and then that you jumped in the queue if you go ahead and do that. I'm cheap, so I didn't bother doing that.
Basically it's a donation of Crunch Labs kit to people who otherwise couldn't afford it. And I put a link in the chat if people are interested in seeing it.
Yeah, but it's kind of fun. I'll see what happens when it comes through in up to a year from now. And that's all I got on that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And again, that was we've had a couple of shares tonight on things, applications that people find useful. And if you have one that it says you can't live without, then we'd like to hear about it too. And we're looking for short presentations. You've seen the kind of thing tonight, 5-15 minutes, whatever. Tell us about it, how it works, why it works for you. And hopefully somebody will find inspiration from your experience, and you'll be promoting the cause of application software being developed by people for use. And just out of interest, if you can't make slides on your own, that slide right there was made by ChatGPT. I just told it what I wanted, and it developed all the wording, including the bullets. So there you go. All right. So next up, we had a question came in, and I wasn't sure we were going to have time to talk about it in any great detail, but it looks like we do. So it's basically about trust. And the main question that came in was about online purchases, and how do you know if you can trust an online purchase site? So even if you have the name of the business, you have its address, if there are testimonials on the web, how can you verify that any or all of these are accurate and truthful? And how do you decide when you're making an online purchase that you're going to enter all your credit card information into that internet form? You've got software which you've obtained from the web, and it might be from supposedly reputable sources like Microsoft and Google. It might have come from shareware on sale, which some of our members recommend. But maybe it came from Joe's software, and you know, who knows who Joe is and whether his software is legitimate or not. And do you buy online? Do you use Best Buy? Do you use Best Buy Marketplace, where you've got third-party resellers? The same kind of thing with Amazon. You've got Amazon.ca, Amazon.com, but a lot of those are not just Amazon suppliers. They're third-party resellers again. So how do you trust all those guys? And maybe you're using something like Kijiji, which is an online purchasing site with an Ottawa branch, for example, but who knows where these people really are. And when you're using a browser to make online purchases, Chris wants to know, what does that lock in the browser really mean? So has anybody got any bright ideas about any or all of the above?
Well, people are thinking about what they're going to say on this. I'll address the last bullet point, because this is something that a lot of people mistakenly will say. They say, oh, well, the lock was in the browser, so it must be safe. All the lock in the browser means is that you have an encrypted session between you and the server at the other end. That's all it means. It doesn't verify the veracity of the person at the other end. You can actually get certificates for free. So it's no barrier for anybody to create an encrypted session between you and them. It does absolutely nothing to verify who it is at the other end. It just means that nobody can sniff the traffic between you and that server. So it's a good thing in that, for sure, if you're putting in credit card information or things like that, or any personal information, nobody can sniff the traffic. But whoever is at the other end is going to get that decrypted traffic come into their computer. And so if you don't trust them, then having an encrypted session doesn't help you an awful lot. So with that, I would love to hear from other people on how they make the decision on whether to trust somebody or not when you're buying something over the internet.
Well, Kijiji is similar to eBay and Etsy, where you can put up your own stuff for sale. That's what most people do with those.
Yeah. But how do you trust, like, if you're going and shopping on Kijiji, and how is it that you decide, I'm going to trust this person, I'm going to buy their thing? You know, especially like if it's in Ottawa, Kijiji, it's probably that you can meet the person, and the Ottawa police will actually assist in that if you want, where you can actually meet the person in the parking lot of a police station, where presumably if it's a scam, the person is going to be loath to meet you in the parking lot of a police station. But presumably you can meet the person, you can check out the goods in person, and you can decide whether you want to part with your cash or not.
But they have ratings as well. I mean, the sellers are rated, the buyers are rated. So
you look for a seller that's got like a 98% or better, and he's got like thousands of, you know, if it's some guy that's got like 50% and there's only like three or four people have bought it, then you pass on that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. For me, what it really comes down to is how badly do I want what's being offered?
Yeah, and what the price and what the loss is. Like, I bought something last weekend. I looked at the review. He had a high rating. He'd done about 50 sales for just a person like me. I thought, well, that's quite a few. And so, of course, I took Chris with me. I gave him a deposit ahead of time so he wouldn't sell it out from underneath me. And I was willing to lose that $20, and it all worked out great. But, yeah, you have to be willing to take a loss.
But you can also get some pretty good deals if you stick at it long enough, too. You just wait until when the bidding is done, and then you see what the lowest one is. The first one I got on eBay was the iPod. Remember the original iPod? And I went to the guy's place that he was selling it, and he congratulated me on being the lowest bid that he'd ever awarded the thing to. I thought that was an interesting thing.
I mean, you can also ask advice of friends and colleagues and so forth that may have dealt with a particular business. Like the example of Shareware on Sale is a good example of that. There's a number of members that have bought software, including Microsoft Office licenses and things like that, at really steep discounts through Shareware on Sale. Now, I don't know anybody who has gotten a license from Shareware on Sale that it turns out it was not a valid license. So just having that experience from other people can help an awful lot as well. So there's that. I guess you could end up doing some searching to see if Joe's Software, and do some searches on Joe's Software reviews or something like that, and see if you get anything back that gives you pause.
What's the URL for the Shareware on Sale? Is it .org or .net or something?
I can't remember. It's
Shareware on Sale. Google will tell you.
Yeah, Google will tell you that for sure.
So Elton has a tip here. He says personally he uses a credit card with a very low limit.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Now, credit cards are also supposed to be limited to, in the event of a scam or whatever, you're only liable for $50. But I have heard that some of the banks that are fronting these credit cards have been claiming that, you were egregiously mishandling your credit card, so therefore you're not capped at a $50 limit. And in those cases, the people, I don't know if they successfully fought it, but they were in the position where they had to fight to actually try to get it with that $50 limit. I don't know how they determined that they were egregiously mishandling their credit card, but I have heard that just recently. But you should be limited to $50 limit in the event of a scam. Another thing on a credit card that I think is a good idea, and using that credit card with a very low limit is probably a good idea as well, because you can get rid of it pretty easily, is only use it for this purpose. And if you have a problem at all, report the card as being stolen. And this can prevent a problem where you get somebody that it's a legitimate website selling something, and it turns out that you signed up for something that is a monthly subscription to pencils, and you get a shipment of 5,000 pencils every month, and you can't get them to stop, and they keep billing your credit card. And so the only way to stop it is to report your credit card stolen. They'll cancel the number, and then that's it. You're not going to get billed anymore. You might still be in a position of having to fight for, the last couple of months' worth or something like that. But be willing to cancel the credit card, and that's why it's good to have a spare credit card that is not your main one. And you can cancel it and then continue on with your normal life and get another new one that you use for the online stuff.
I bought a lot of stuff on eBay.
Using PayPal. I think PayPal gives you some protection if you have a problem, does it not?
Yes, it does. I've used eBay a lot, and I find it there's several transactions that didn't go well, and I got a full refund from eBay. So eBay is quite safe. You may not get what you wanted, but in that case, you'll get your money back. PayPal is also another layer.
Yeah,
and so is your credit card, because your credit card can reverse the charges and put it back on the person who tried to charge you. So there are several, that way you have several layers that any of which could give you your money back.
Yeah. Eventually, I think it does come down to the idea that you're going to have to, at some point, decide you're going to trust it or not trust it. And
well, Amazon's return policy thing is pretty darn good. I had a drive that was dead on arrival when I got it, and they already sent me the box and everything else before I'd even filled in the rest of the forms to send it back.
Yeah, watch with Amazon, and this is something that I do on Amazon. I will not, like, I'll buy through the third parties on Amazon, but only if it's shipped from Amazon. Because if it's shipped from the third party, then you have to go through them to get a refund and return the item and things like that. And they're loath to actually give you a refund, whereas Amazon, they just, you know, if you have something that is sold by ABC Computing and it's shipped from Amazon, when you return it, you're returning it to Amazon, and Amazon doesn't give a damn. Because they're just going to charge back the reseller. So they'll happily accept any returns without any question at all. And as Steve says, I've had that too, where I get the refund before I've even returned the item. And Amazon just doesn't care because, you know, typically these things don't even get returned to the reseller, the third party. They get just, you know, because the third party is too much of a pain for them to deal with it and things like that. So they get sold in big pallets of goods from Amazon. So yeah, I highly recommend that if you're buying from Amazon, only buy from either sold by Amazon or sold by a third party but shipped from Amazon.
Well, Ron Smith, or I think it's Ron Smith, the guy that's on Tech for Senior, he told me that if you look through the Amazon thing for the pricing, you'll see one that says warehouse deals. And what that actually is one where the box that it's in has been scraped or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And it's usually a pretty good discount on it. So if you see one that's an Amazon warehouse deal and it's shipped by Amazon and the rest of it all by Amazon, you can get the stuff and it comes and it's still in the box, brand new. Even if it says used, yeah. I've had that a couple of times and had a great success with that.
Bill has a comment there that he had one item but he returned. Amazon refunded the money and told him to keep it. that's a bonus if it's just something that is, I mean, if it's totally garbage, it's no good for you, but who knows, it might be something that's still useful. And I've heard of that before. I've never had Amazon tell me to just keep it. But I've heard other people say the same thing.
Well, Amazon, also, you need to claim back within 30 days, so don't go over the limit.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I guess anything that you buy online, I'll take a look at the refund policies and make sure that if you're unhappy with it, you know.
And take a look at the item itself. Don't just leave it in the box in the closet for a couple of months and then open it and decide it's not what you wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Best Buy has spoken that their marketplace sales, they will have nothing to do with it if you have a problem. Yeah. So when I'm looking at Best Buy, I just don't touch anything from their marketplace at all.
Yeah, same here.
Because you have no means of recourse except trying to deal with them specifically.
Yeah.
Well, I bought stuff online from Best Buy, and I had a subwoofer that I bought online from them, and it turned out to be a hell of a lot bigger than it looked like on their image. So I just took it back to the store. They gave me the refund on the spot, and that was it.
Yeah, if it's sold by Best Buy, that's true. Yeah. But if it's their third place, their marketplace sellers, then it's third parties, and then you have to deal with the third party. Best Buy won't take it back. You know, they'll say, no, you bought it through the marketplace. You deal with the marketplace seller.
Mm.
If you buy from L.L. Bean and you don't like the item that you bought, you can take it right back to the store here in Ottawa, and they give you the refund right there. It takes probably an extra day longer for the refund to come through, but we've done that, and my wife has never had any problem with anything she's taken back. But what we do is, I guess we're really old school, because like if I deal with hotels or trips or anything like that, I call directly so that I can get a person from the agency that's representing them. I don't buy anything like that online at all. I don't trust it. I did book a hotel once in when my uncle passed away in out in the Cambridge area, and I looked up I forget the name of the chain, a very, you know, a popular name brand chain. And when I paid for the room, all of a sudden I got an email from some seller who had hacked into my transaction, and it was somewhere in the States. And they wanted a marketing fee. They wanted conversion to U.S. dollars. And I thought I was really in trouble, but I actually managed to get in touch with them. They were in somewhere like Arizona, and I told them how appalled I was that they actually hacked into my transaction to get this. I wanted my money back right away, and they gave it to me immediately.
Oh, really?
When I was, and then I phoned the hotel chain that I wanted to deal with. I told them what had happened, and they said, "Oh yeah, that happens all the time."
Oh, jeez.
Great. Thanks very much.
I think I'd stop dealing with that chain.
Yeah, well, I booked a room directly because it was close to where I had to be for the funeral service, so that worked out. But we're very, very careful with stuff. I have had to send some things back, and I haven't had any problems with that through Kijiji, for example. Through Amazon. But I'm also very careful with what I pick from Amazon too. But I've always had everything delivered. I actually bought a lens through Amazon a number of years ago, and it was a lens or another piece of photographic equipment, and it just didn't fit. So it was poorly manufactured. I sent it back, and I got a full refund, including the shipping that I had to pay to send it back. But again, that's Amazon, not any kind of third party seller.
Yeah.
Another one to be careful of is Temu. Whatever you do, don't register an account on your cell phone.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Okay, we are just coming up on 8:30, so I think we should cut this off at this point. If anybody has any other suggestions, throw them into suggestion box at opcug.ca, and in 2 weeks we'll have another Q&A session, and at that point we could put up some slides of any additional ideas that people have. So thanks everybody for participation in this. I think some really, really great ideas, and I think with that we should throw it off to Alan to wrap it up for the evening.
Okay, so coming events. Our presentations with the library. If you want to know about protecting your PC, then tomorrow in Manotick, Chris is going to be talking about that. You want to be able to edit your photographs, then Linda's going to do that at Orleans on Tuesday the 10th. And on Thursday the 12th, that's after the Pizza Q, Chris has a quick tips on using free tools for enhancing performance. As always, you need to register with the library for those presentations so you get the you get your name down on the sheet, and you just hit the link there and it will take you to the list of presentations. Okay, so the final thing we have is our public service announcement. I said this was the last call, And if I can find Bob Harris right here, we'll give him slide control. And the same for... Sorry, technical difficulty here. What's going on? Okay.
I see it. Very good.
You have slide control. You're on the...
We sure do. Very good.
Is it to be on a Saturday instead of a Wednesday?
No, it's Wednesday, June 11th. And,
yeah, I have updated the date on the deck, so that is correct now.
There we go. And before you arrive, you'll want to know about this for sure. This, yes, is our biggest event of the year. And this year is no different. And the registration this year is going really well. You can see I'm at the pizza. I'm at the station right now. We have lots of room here at the Trolley Station. But the registration this year, this is turning out to be our biggest year ever. We have lots of new members coming in. And welcome to the new members, by the way. You'll see new people at this year's event. If you're into Google and you want to find the Trolley Station, Google 102 Greenview Avenue. It'll take you to here. Now, 102 is Greenview is actually the Ron Kobus Center, which is a little too far. But you want to turn right into the parking lot just before the Ron Kobus Center at 102 Greenview. In the parking lot, then look to your left. You'll see me right here. I'm there. I'm here right now at the Trolley Station. And there's lots of room for you here. Now, the weather is not a problem here. Rain or shine, our location is perfect. And in spite of our large numbers this year, we still have lots of room. So rain or shine, we're covered here. We have lots of, we have free parking here. And it's going to be a great event. Now, I want to turn things over to Gail, who has some very important updates you all need to know about. Take it away, Gail.
Hi, hi everyone. This is Gail. I'm the OPCUG secretary, in case you didn't know. So we really want everyone to register, and I'm hoping that Bob will do the slides because I can't. So we want you to tell us. We want to know who's coming in advance, and because we want to be able to order in the right amount of food. 1 year we didn't have registration and we ordered way too much pizza, but we also don't want to run out. Next slide, please. So the URL, was that on the previous slide? Sorry, may you go back for a sec? So the URL there is pizzaparty@opcug.ca. So we're asking you to tell us the kind of pizza you want. It could be meat lover, ham and cheese, gluten-free, vegetarian, whatever you like. I actually ordered anything with bacon. Please let us know how many guests you want to bring and also their names.
Once you register, you'll get a response back from a real person. Sorry, yeah.
Not a robot. Oh, my goodness. we have some news for you today. So we have new member, a brand new OPCUG member. She joined after hearing Chris's Fun with Fonts Library presentation, and she was completely captivated by it. Turns out she's just as passionate about typography as Chris is. That's hard to imagine. She agreed right up front to join the OPCUG, and she's really excited about coming to the pizza party. Next slide. Her name is Raven Inkwell, and she has an interesting background. She's a tattoo artist, which totally explains why she's so drawn to Chris's font presentation. She told us that the pizza party will be a refreshing change from her usual stuff, a different type of clientele and a different type of gathering. Next slide, please. I just want to add that at the presentation, we're going to be having name tags. I think you've all seen me or the old not old members, but former members, people who have been around for a while, have seen me bring name tags to our in-person events. And we'll be making name tags for members and guests, the kind that you wear around your neck at a business conference. So we'd like everyone to wear theirs proudly. And you can call each other by names easily. You can put a face to a name that you've you've seen faces on Zoom. Now you know who they are, and it'll make a really big difference for networking and finding new friends. But in addition, we're going to have a second option. Raymond suggested that as well as name tags, we could have face tattoos. So now you'll have two options at the pizza party. We have Raven to thank for this. And she, if you go to the next slide, you can see that Bob and I tried out her services. And she will put a face, a tattoo on your forehead. Look at those gorgeous fonts. And so you can have a name tag or a more permanent solution. So over to you, Bob. So as I said, the choice is yours, removable, returnable, practical name tags, or permanent, artistic, and unforgettable face tattoos. Both options will be available for you. Bob, we can't hear you. Bob, we can't hear you.
You're not muted, but we don't hear any sound from you. No, your microphone is disconnected, I think.
So as you know, just go back for a minute to the next slide. Oh. This is our main in-person event of the year, and it's really a good time to put faces to names. Next slide, please. So you'll meet new people, but don't just sit there and have your pizza, mingle and get to know everyone. Just 7 days to go, so don't forget to register and bring your appetite and your friendly attitude and choose wisely for the name tags or tattoo the night of the event. Next slide. See everyone there.
Okay, so thanks very much to Gail and thanks very much to Bob, and we'll see you all at the pizza party. And so that means that there will be no Q&A next week. And in fact, there will be no Zoom meeting next week because obviously the pizza queue, pizza party, is an in-person event. So our next Q&A session will be on June the 18th. So you have 2 weeks to get in all your questions and your shares and the answers to how you shop online. Just send us an email and we'll build a deck for 2 weeks' time. So hope everybody enjoyed the evening, lots of stuff, good discussion, and thanks very much for attending. See you next week.